Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
And get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
Now then, very happy to say, Paul McGinley joins us. We are talking about the boy Bryson DeChambeau, who has won the US Open in emphatic fashion, utterly emphatic. 6 under par was his final total, the only player to finish up under par at wing foot. Paul, there are many statistics you can take from his performance. One which jumped out at me, his final round, he was 7.9, let's round it up to 8. He was 8 shots better than the average player. That is the biggest margin since Johnny Miller back in 1973 with his 63 at Oakmont. This was the quality of performance we saw from DeChambeau.
Yeah, it was, Joe. And I mean, I think that's been lost a little bit in so much talk about the big hitting is how well he performed right through the bag, putter, wedge, course management as well. I mean, I know it looked like it was just stand up and thrash it as far as he can, find it and hit it again. There was a lot more went into it than just that. I mean, a lot of these holes were on dog legs. And if you look at how he approached it, very rarely did he miss it on the short side of the dog leg. He was always on the wide part, on the elbow part. Give himself an angle, even if he was coming from the rough, he always had a shot out. And I mean, they're so powerful out of the rough. I mean, I got my first glimpse of this, Joe, was 2012. I remember being on the radio as a vice captain to Aldazabal, and he wanted an update. I was following Rory's match, and I said, "Oh, Rory's got no shot. He's got 9 iron at best, probably a chip out though." And next of all, out comes Rory with a 7 or a 6 iron, and this thing launched. Not long did it come out, but the height it came out. And that was the first time I'd really seen that. I hadn't seen it before. That was 2012. I'd seen good guys out of rough, but it was normally knuckleballs that came out of the rough. But I'd never seen launch and spin coming out like that. And kind of that's the way the game has gone the last number of years. And that used to be just Rory. Only a few guys could do it, a handful of guys. And now there's a whole lot more.
And is that power, as in their physical power, or is it technology?
A bit of both. Mostly power and approach angle, attack angle, very steep in on the ball. Doesn't matter how thick the grass is behind it, they're able to get right in on top of the ball, cover it. And it's just incredible how high. I mean, there was a couple of shots last week. I saw them coming out, and not alone were they coming out with distance, but, you know, hitting it over trees that are 70, 80, 100 foot high. And that's what's so extraordinary about it. And of course, the other benefit, the side benefit of that is it comes down a lot softer on the greens. Than the knuckleball. So they're coming out with spin and height, and that's how they're getting it to stop on the greens.
Because you would have swung the club around you a little bit. You would have a flatter swing. Yeah. So, that, I mean, you getting out of that rough with that kind of swing plane or swing, you know, would have been near impossible.
Terrible. I was terrible out of the rough, Joe. One of the worst. I really was. I remember the 2004 Ryder Cup in Detroit, and I was petrified of hitting in the rough when I was playing foursomes because my partner hit it in the rough because it was so difficult for me out of the rough, you know, a flat swinger and you know, too much grass between the club face and the ball. And all I could do out of the rough was chase it. Now, if the fairways were relatively firm, I could get on top of it with an 8 iron with a bit of loft and squeeze it, which I still do. And I'm able to chase it 50, 60 yards along the green. But if there's a bunker short or water short, dead. And again, moving on to technology, again, the big game changer for me was when they came out with the rescue clubs. And I remember seeing Padraig that for the first time using 3 and 4 iron rescues. And I started using them. And that was a game changer for me my last few years on tour, because now at a semi-rough, I could flight the ball 180, 190 yards in the air, even out of a semi-rough lie, which I couldn't have done with an iron, if you know what I mean.
I've checked and double-checked this next statistic on the USGA website and on the PGA website and anywhere else I could check it. Bryson this week was the 7th longest off the tee. He was averaging 325 yards. So, you know, Dustin Johnson was 333, right down to McIlroy just ahead of Bryson on 328 to Bryson's 325. So is this because he wasn't necessarily taking driver off every tee, or what's your interpretation of that?
A bit of that, but also the fact the other guys are just as long. And the other thing to remember as well is because the other guys were hitting more fairways and the run that they were getting on the fairways was probably equating to more distance.
Okay.
They're all around the same distance, Joe. There's not a massive difference. This Bryson is not 30 yards outside Rory. You know, Rory's talking like he's playing another game than Rory. He's not. He's playing the exact same game that Rory was so brilliant at. It's just that so many guys are able to do it now.
Yes, it's interesting you say that, because if anyone casually is keeping an eye on this, they will be under the impression that DeChambeau is doing something nobody has done and is doing it by a massive margin.
No, that's not the case. That's not the case, no. The reason why there's been a lot of narrative around it this week is because he's gone into the bastion of what a US Open always has been, you know, all the history of it, all tight fairways, narrow fairways, thick rough, you know, that DNA of what a US Open always has been. Mm. And he's been totally dismissive from the very first day he got there last Monday or Tuesday and said, no, I don't care about the tight rough. I don't care about the tight fairways. I'm going to approach this US Open with a way that you guys haven't seen before. I'm just going to bash it as far as I can. And that was almost like blasphemy that he would say that about a US Open. And that's where the narrative has come from. And that's what's accentuated. But look, this is the way that all the guys play. This is nothing new. You know, there's such a big talk around it, but this is nothing new than what we've seen in the last number of years on the PGA Tour. And that's why, you know, the guys are so good, because they just basically overpower golf courses, and they whip it around dog legs and not bothered at all if they're in the rough, because they can still advance at 220, 230 yards out of rough.
What was very interesting is that on the press conferences across Tuesday and Wednesday, was it seems even the younger players, even McIlroy, I think, they were still of the opinion that, okay, you know, we can bomb and gouge it plenty, but at the US Open, we've got to respect this rough. And it came to DeChambeau, and the reporter said, well, look, I presume, Bryson, for this tournament, you know, whatever about the others, this one, you're going to respect the fairways rule, US Open. And I mean, geez, talk about prophetic. He just said, I mean, the guys who lay up, a lot of the time they're going to end up in the rough anyway. So instead of hitting a 5-iron out of the rough, I'm bombing it and I'll get a wedge or a 9-iron to it. I'll get to the front of the green. That's my strategy, and away I go. And I mean, it was like he'd had a glimpse into the future. But it was, my point is that other players thought that they still had to respect the US Open traditions for this week.
Yeah. And that's not earlier about being blasphemous, that he would do that to a US Open and quite brazenly say, no, you're all wrong. This is how you're going to approach it. And he was proved right in the end. He was proved absolutely right. That is how you do it, because even the shorter hitters, I mean, the field were only averaging 40% of fairways. Even the shorter, straighter hitters were only, you know, 40, 60%. I think Brendan Todd was first in that. But Rory was third in drive and accuracy. You know, so there he had a massive advantage, because he was hitting more fairways. He was hitting the ball as far as Bryson and hitting more fairways as well. And, you know, it definitely, of course, it's easier coming out of a fairway because you can spin it. And, you know, that's what we saw the first day. You know, the scoring was spectacular the first day, really, wasn't it? 21 guys under par.
So take the Brendan Todd example. And like, I don't know if we want to rig golf so that you're not rewarded for hitting the ball a long way. I mean, you know, go back to Nicklaus, go back however, you know, however far you want. Hitting a long way is an unbelievable skill. And, you know, when we're at events, you marvel at seeing it. But so to bring a Brendan Todd more into competition with a Bryson for the purposes of this week, do we have to shorten the rough further away from the green so he can hit his 5-iron into that rough? Like, how do we make this a bit more equitable?
Well, I mean, look, big hitting, as you say, has always been an important part. All the greats in the game, the really greats in the game, have generally been bigger hitters. You know, Tiger certainly was, and Jack, the top two players in the history of the game, were huge hitters of their generation. So there's a huge, big report going on, Joe, for the last 2 years, basically gathering information. The RNA and the USGA, the two governing bodies of golf in the world, have gathered this massive report. They came out in February with a statement to say, yeah, you know what, it has gone too far. We don't want it to go any further. And now we realize and have collected all the data, let us go away and come back with some recommendations. With COVID and everything else that's happened, they've been very quiet over the last 6 months, and there haven't been any journalists able to be inquisitive to them. And I'm sure there'll be a lot more questions after watching what happened last week on a DNA of a US Open golf course. So we await to what their recommendation is going to do, Joe. But it's not quite simply, change the regulations on the equipment and technology, because you've got, you know, manufacturers out there who have spent hundreds of millions in research and development to go down there. They're going to resist it. But the biggest voice is all, which you've got to remember, is that the players themselves, remember the PGA Tour and the European Tour are members organizations. So the players are incredibly powerful in golf, more so than any other sport. The participants hold all the power and a lot of the leverage when the decision makings come. Now, the RNA and USGA might think they're the governing bodies, and to a large extent they are. But when it comes to professional golf, the players have a massive say in what happens. So do you really think that you look at the top 10 in the world rankings at the moment, do you think that all of those guys who are all massive hitters and play this way are going to vote for a change in technology and lose the advantage that they have now? Do you think that they're going to go up to the RNA and say, you've got to do something about the equipment? No, absolutely. Turkeys are not going to vote for Christmas. So we're at an incredibly important stage now in the history of the game. And the RNA and the USGA have got to step up to the plate, and they've got to take on a very strong voice of not just the players, but also the PGA Tour, who are backing the players, that, you know, technology doesn't need to change. And then, of course, you've got the looming threat of a potential lawsuit in the background. So there's a lot of moving parts going on here, Joe. It's not just quite simply go out and change technology and everybody accepts it and move on.
No, I hear you. When you were watching, say, Thursday's coverage, an easier day than the others in particular, and we have 9 irons going in versus, I think, 2006, you might have had, certainly 5 irons.
Six irons.
Okay. Did you watch that this week and think, I don't like this now? I don't like winged foot being played this way. This is not the game. Or are you okay with it?
I didn't like it. I don't like this modern game, to be honest, Joe. I don't. You know, you call me traditionalist or, you know, a naysayer with the modern game. I don't think there's as much skill. It's more brawn. I think game should always be game skill. You know, if you're, I'm lucky. I mean, 5'7", me, never had fast ball speed. I mean, I don't think I could have been a professional golfer in the modern era. I don't think I had the skill set. I could never have generated that speed. I wasn't born with that speed. I wasn't born physically, and I didn't have it in my swing either. So, you know, should you rule out everybody who's kind of short or small or not particularly strong, like a Corey Pavin, from ever being successful? He was an incredibly, still is an incredibly skillful player, able to move the ball both ways. There's so many different skill sets involved in the game, in playing the game well. We all know that. There's the guy, I need to have the mental part of it. There's the strategy part of it. There's ability to play bunker shots. There's ability to play chip shots. I mean, you know, drivers, three woods, you know, all of the things. Got to move the ball right to left, got to move the left to right, got to hit it under the wind, got to gauge where the wind is. So you talk about the pentathlon being a sport, which is a real true sport, the original Olympic sport, because it had so many different skill sets needed. Well, look at golf. I mean, in golf, there's so many different skill sets involved. And, you know, the shame is that we are out of balance with those skill sets at the moment. Of course, big hitting is important. It always has been, and it always isn't it advantageous to be a big hitter in the game. I'm not denying that and not saying that should go away, but it's out of balance now. I mean, just to give you an example, I mean, you were there last year when I played down in Adair Manor, the opening of Adair Manor with Rory. I mean, I had a good drive off the first hole, Joe, and I'm probably hitting it longer now than I did on tour. And I was hitting a 4-iron in there, second shot. Rory hit a wedge in there, and he wasn't even a big wedge. Now, okay, you could say I'm 50 years of age and, you know, I'm not the same, but still, the difference, the disparity between the longest and the shortest on tour now, and now Graham McDowell wouldn't be much longer than me or Jim Furyk even now. They will be hitting 4 or 5 irons into that green and Rory's hitting wedge. So who are you going to back in that situation? There's a massive, massive advantage. And when I played, you know, John Daly, who I would have played with a lot, and Tiger, who I would have played with not as much, but still, you know, quite frequently, they were 20 yards outside me. Maximum 25, no more than that. But they weren't 70, 80 yards outside me like the bigger hitters are now. So Graham and Jim are giving away 70, 80 yards to the bigger hitters. And a lot of that goes back to technology, which I explained to you before, the trampoline effect off the driver. The more you bend the face, the more you're going to get a bounce off it. And that's why the guys with the big ball speed have quantifiably really, really had an advantage with this modern technology.
Yeah. I didn't want to say it to you at the time. You caught that drive in Adair off the heel. But look, if you thought you hit it well, fair enough. to wrap up on DeChambeau, because like this gets very interesting. He's putting the 48-inch driver into play in his next PGA Tour event, by the way, and he's going to try and add 10 more pounds of bulk at Augusta. So he's going to keep on doing his thing. What he represents for golf is very interesting, both the distance debate and then also, you know, like, he's a polarizing figure. He is. If you want the cartoon villain for Manny, he could be it. I mean, I just saw there, he was interviewed by Todd Lewis and he's come out with the phrase, I dominated winged foot, you know. So there's an arrogance there. We've seen the rules officials. We've seen I'm going to live till I'm 140. He's had meltdowns on the course. This is, whether you like him or not, this is pretty interesting for golf. Like, I sure as hell want to see his group in a featured group in Augusta, put it that way. Your thoughts on DeChambeau, the full package?
I honestly think he's brilliant. I think as much as I don't like the game he's playing, that's not his fault. He's right to do what he's doing. He's right to have data drive him down in that direction and look at all the data, being a scientist and think, hey, this is the advantage. This is where I can get an edge. This is what I need to do. And then go about it physically to build himself up to be able to do that. I'm full of admiration for him. I think, Joe, just like golf would be boring if every course was exactly the same, I think professional golf would be boring if everybody was the same personality. And a lot of people in professional golf are painted with the brush of everybody's bland and everybody's got the short haircut, you know, and the khaki trousers and dress the same way and act the same way and give the same sound bites. And I think that this guy is a brilliant narrative in the game. And great narratives don't mean that everybody always with them. And the fact that he's a little bit different, a little bit funky, that's okay. I mean, I remember saying this to you a few months ago. I really like this guy. I've spent a bit of time in his company, and I've really enjoyed him. I found him incredibly respectful, incredibly interesting, and also questioning. You know, a guy who comes back with a lot of questions as well, too, which is like is always a really good insight into somebody's personality. So I personally like him, but I also like what he's bringing to the game of golf and that uniqueness, that different. Coming in from left field with a whole load of eccentricities, if you want to call it, and then getting results on the back of it. I mean, listen, with all due respect, Pádraig is the same. You know, that's what makes Pádraig so interesting. Pádraig didn't look at it through the same lens that most people did. Pádraig came in a little bit from left field like Bryson did. I'm not saying he's anywhere out there near where Bryson is, but he did come in that. And that's what makes him so interesting and so unique as well, too, and why... You know, we all enjoy what he has to say and what his insights on the game are because they come from left field. You're not going to agree with all of them, but that's good. And you know, as I say, golf would be very boring if all of the players treated the game and acted in the exact same way. And my only worry would be, back to your earlier question, would be that, you know, the problem is we're starting to see regularly now, week after week, these bigger hitters, you know, week on week, certainly when it comes to the big, I mean, look at the winners, the last five winners of the US Open, you know, the days of Corey Pavin are gone. You know, he was the shortest hitter on tour at the time, but because he was able to move the ball all over the golf course with incredible skill and great putting and great guile, he was able to win. But I think those days are gone, and that's a shame for golf. And I'd like to see, you know, see that brought back, because if you're not born nowadays with massive ball speed, or you're not able to generate massive ball speed, you're at a distinct massive disadvantage.
Yeah, Bones McKay was in the TV coverage over in the States, and he was saying, you know, the message to every youngster, teenager and younger is swing speed, which is kind of not, you know, I mean, I suspect when you were growing up, you were hearing about things like rhythm and, you know, don't hit at the ball and all this stuff. So it's a different game.
Absolutely. I mean, it was all about the classic swing, you know, and it was about how you swung the club, Joe, and getting it in positions. Look at Nick Faldo. You know, that was a completely different era. That was all about the classic swing and delivering the club back square all the time. Now it's about brute power. And the game has seismically changed in that way.
So he trampled the field, as we've said, and it wasn't just his long game, as we've also said. You know, escape shots when he was under pressure, chipping was brilliant. He put it brilliantly. Like, for instance, he finished 10 shots ahead of McIlroy but took 12 fewer putts. Now, I know strokes gained is a more accurate measurement of that, but it's noteworthy. So, you know, McIlroy, your thoughts on him, tied eighth, 3 under day one. You know, if you take it from that point, because so often he's blown himself out of these things on day one, but then on the two toughest days, the Friday he shot a 76 and on the Sunday he shot a 75. You often use the phrase an exam, you know, different exams. He's not passing those tougher exams.
No. No, he's not, Joe. And that's a worry for him. That's something he needs to fix, because he's got the skill set. There's no doubt. We've seen that. And when we all talk about how talented he is. But I think that talent turns against him sometimes insofar as it brings a lot of expectation. He knows he's the guy. He knows a lot of guys are looking at him, and knows everybody, a lot of us in the game, paint him as the best player in the game. And I think that brings a lot of expectation. I think he struggles with that.
Do you? Even though he's had that expectation since he was a prodigy teenager.
Winning majors is expectation, Joe, you know, and I really do. I really do. I mean, you know, he gets himself in contention and then he gets himself out of contention. And then when you think he's out of contention, you get himself back in again. And I think that's, you know, that burden of expectation with one so talented. And he's not the only one to do it. I mean, you know, you take somebody like Ernie Els. I mean, this is a huge hurdle for somebody so talented, is dealing with that expectation. It's a difficult place to be in, that favorite, that position where everybody's expecting you to perform. You're almost cornered. I remember Nicholas saying this to me years and years ago, when I had dinner with him, I just turned pro. And he elaborated a lot during that dinner on the expectation, how he found Trevino such a difficult opponent, because Trevino always put him in a corner where he couldn't win. He said all he did was tell everybody in the media and anybody who wanted to listen how great Jack Nicklaus was, and everybody should come and watch this guy. This guy's amazing. Everybody should come and watch how talented this Nicklaus is. And he said, you know what? I felt it. I really felt that place. I had nowhere to go because I was cornered. And guys who are so talented, it is a big challenge for them. You know, of course, he's done well and he's won his tournaments and all, you know, majors and all of that kind of things. But, you know, we're 6 years waiting on him to win another major, his fifth major. And, you know, the pressure is building. It's not going the other way. And we saw that with Montgomery's career. We saw with Westwood's career. The further into their career they got, it didn't become easier to win majors. It becomes more difficult. And it's a tough place to be for any sports person, sports team or athlete.
It's interesting. I mean, you do feel he's trying to talk himself into this business. You know, he talks about his new perspective and golf's not everything to me. And that's really been his mantra over the last couple of years. And, you know, a bit like Harrington, who sometimes used the media to almost try and talk to himself. You wonder if that's what McIlroy's doing to an extent. He was 50th in putting, you know, if we're looking for certain markers in his game. How did it look to you? Because, like, it's been very hit and miss over the last couple of months. It did look a bit better.
Yeah, it did look better, Joe. There's no doubt. I thought he did quite well last week. He wasn't a million miles away. In really tough conditions, it was one of his better performances in really tough conditions. The last day was very disappointing. I think he lost, you know, you're highlighting his putting there. His putting up after the first 3 days was actually quite good. He's one of their players, you know, statistics and putting was very good after three rounds, but he lost a lot of ground in that category in the last day where he had a four putt and two three putts. And that's why his putting has been reflected now, has been really poor, where actually it was actually quite good. But the last day was the problem. The second day and the last day, as you highlighted, when conditions were easy the first day and the course was soft and, you know, he could take it on and play when he revels, that spring in his step, he's able to play that aggressive golf. He's an aggressive style of player. And when the test requires a negative, if you want to call it that, or an approach that's more cautious, that's when he struggles. He struggles to be aggressive in a cautious style setup. That's his problem. And that's where, and I don't know, and you know, but my guess is, you know, what game plan did he have? I'd like to know the game plan going out there because, you know, I was watching, for example, take that first hole. I mean, this is just my insight. I'm watching that first hole where he four-putted and started with a double bogey. You know, he's going out with an outside chance to win, albeit, let's say that, but it is an outside chance, and he's ripped it up the first fairway. The wind is in off the right. So the wind has been the same all week long, well, after the first day. So he said pretty much the same wind, and because of the nature of the greens, the pin positions were very similar on a lot of the holes. In fact, they used the same pin position again pretty much because that's the way the design of the greens had to be. So the course was playing very similar a lot of days. So where was the game plan? You take that first hole, which was playing in and out of the right, which he played on day two, he played on day three. The pin was in that pocket back left. And, you know, I watched for 3 hours before the leaders went out. We were on air very early, and you know, watching everybody coming into that hole, and that was either one of the holes where you could be aggressive on because it was a backstop in there of 7 or 8 yards. The one place you couldn't miss it was kind of short right because then it would camber off the front of the green. But you could go in and be aggressive with that. And yet he missed it in position, the wrong place, and it hit the slope and came back to 60 feet. And then again, you know, his first putt, again, he could have put it at 6 or 7 yards past the flag and it would have come back down to have a six-footer for par, but he didn't. He tried to get it just over the ridge, got it quite wrong, and it came back down. And before you know it, you're in a double bogey. So what was the game plan for that hole? Had he not watched early play? Had they sussed out how this course was playing and what they needed to do? The first five holes are going to be critical. I said that in the analysis at the start. They were the five of the most difficult holes in the golf course. Getting through those in level par, which were already highlighted the day before, getting through the first five holes, and he's right to highlight them, was really critical. So what was his plan on the last day for those five holes? And you know, that first hole pin position was difficult. If you're going in with a 7-iron or a 6-iron, but going in with a wedge like he was, it wasn't particularly difficult. And that was a time to be aggressive. That wasn't a time to back off. And you know, he came out of it and kind of backed off, tried to hit in the middle of the green and ended up with a 6. So they're the kind of things, you know. Other than that, he did okay. You know, he battled away as best he could. And unfortunately, double bogey in 16, you know, put him back out of it again. But he's not as far away as many would think. And it's a little bit tightening up. And I think a better game plan going into those difficult days, and trying to change his mindset. So instead of being cautious, I want to be aggressive in a cautious situation, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Very, very last one. Tiger. What do we see from Tiger? He'll be defending champion at Augusta in November.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, the writing looks like it's on the wall, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, we have to say that. He didn't look at the races last week. But let's not rule him out. If there is one of the four majors where he can contend, you'd have to say it's Augusta. The second best chance he's going to have in contending in a major is going to be the Open Championship. But the other two are going to be very difficult in the modern game.
Mm. Paul McGinley, great stuff. Enjoyed the coverage on Sky Sports over the week. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome, Joe. Thank you.
The OTB Podcast Network.